if you're new to hunting, I think one thing that like really makes people not as successful is like a constant act of self-guessing. I kind of say that I have, in some ways, like happy feet. I like to cruise around. I like to move around a lot. If you're bad at glassing and you don't like glassing, develop tactics that you can be successful at without glassing. I had one guy like who was sending me a message that I absolutely didn't know how to hunt because I was carrying a backpack around that had all my scent in it. At this point, I've actually spent more days out hunting than not hunting. It was just pretty crazy to think. This is Remy Warren, and you're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
There's a lot of people that can pull the trigger on an animal, but they don't know what to do with it after.
If you would have told me that a stupid turkey was going to make me get that excited, I'd have told you you were crazy.
It's just a skill that you have to perfect over a lot of years.
Hunting is a tribal activity. We've lost the tribe. We can't even hunt together anymore.
Well, the people that are anti-hunting are usually pro-abortion. So kill the people, save the animals.
I just remember riding my horse back to camp with the northern lights and the moose behind me, and I'm like, this is why I've done this. This is as cool as an experience as I will get.
Hi, this is Jim Shockey.
This is Sam Sohol, the public land bus guy.
Hi, I'm Kimmy Greentree.
Hi, this is South Cox with the Western Bowhunter Podcast.
Hey, this is Ben DeDamonte, a.k.a. Shed Crazy.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, so getting on to today's episode, I am super excited to have the one and only Remy Warren on the show. Remy is just a super, super smart dude when it comes to this world of hunting. He's done a little bit of everything. And so I'm excited to have him on and hear his story. Remy, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's good to get a chance to sit down and talk for a little bit.
Heck yeah. So, you know, we got a chance to just sit for a moment at Western Hunting Summit. Was awesome event. It was really great to meet you out there and hear what you had to say about mule deer hunting. But I'm excited to come in and actually just learn a little bit more about you. So I would honestly love if you could start out just with a little bit about yourself and how'd you get started in hunting and the outdoors? Where did you, what kicked it off for you?
I mean, I kind of like grew up hunting and in the outdoors. My dad hunted. So I would just kind of go out with him. And I mean, I can't even remember a time that I didn't love hunting or didn't want to go hunting. I mean, there's pictures of me just like as a toddler with a toy gun, like following my dad around, you know, while he's hunting sage hen or whatever, getting to carry his birds and other things. You know, it's just something I just grew up with and really fell in love with. And it's just, for me, it's like, it's just kind of like part of my life. It's something that I've always like just been super passionate about. And even though my dad got me into hunting, you know, I was the type that I just like, I loved it so much. I kind of took it to that next level and then even brought him along with me. You know, he was more, he enjoyed hunting, but I don't think that he was as passionate about it as I was. And then he saw that passion and he got more excited. It was something that we could do together. And, you know, kind of like, I kind of started pushing him to hunt more, which is cool too. And yeah, so I think that that's pretty much how I got started, like growing up in it really.
So did you ever, I hear from a lot of guys that kind of grew up in the hunting, they went through these waves where maybe they went through like college or high school and just completely fell out of it. Did you ever go through any of that, or has it always just been like train never went off the tracks? It was always hunting.
Oh yeah. No, the train never went off the tracks. Like it's all I've thought about since I've had like coherent thoughts, which is good because people, you know, like people ask like, oh, do you get sick of it? Like it's work and, you know, like as a guide and whatever. I mean, the most days I spent in the field in 1 year, obviously before I was married, but like 323 days. That was as many, that was like the days that I've been out in a single year of hunting or guy, like in some facet of like being out hunting. And I never got sick of it. Like it wasn't, it's just something that I can get up and do every single day, which is awesome. Like it's a true, the truest passion that I can think of. And it's something that I never like, you know, I never was really into anything else. Now I'm like, I'll do other things, but I still just only think, eat, breathe, sleep, hunting, and fishing, you know. fishing as well, but outdoor stuff mostly.
So you grew up hunting, you went and then you started up a guide service. How old were you when you started guiding?
It was shortly after high school. I kind of like after I graduated high school, I just started taking all my college classes in the spring and summer semesters. And that gave me August through, January, off to like essentially hunt, work, whatever. So I kind of took that entire fall season off and, kind of started guiding in Montana. I like went up to Montana and got a guiding job there and started guiding elk and deer, kind of general unit combo hunts. And then that kind of, you know, as that kind of progressed, I kind of got jobs other places, South Dakota, New Mexico. And then eventually I've guided in South Africa and New Zealand. So kind of like all over the world, done some of the guiding and stuff and in a lot of different states and a lot of different places. But, I pretty much just started kind of like after high school. And then I would take that money that I made during the guiding season. And then I would just go to school the rest of the year and kind of live off my guide salary for the rest of the year. So it was pretty cool. It was a great way to do it for sure.
Jeez, it's funny. You know, I think about, you know, we talked a little bit earlier and I kind of mentioned this is a fairly new thing to me over the past few years. And, I look back and I think about what I was doing in college and I'm like, oh man, if only I'd known about this world. Like I just didn't even, I don't know. It was just never even a thought to me back in my 20s. And, we won't discuss the stuff I was doing back then, but, it's a very, very different world. So it's such an interesting thing, like hearing that and, you know, hearing about you just hunting all over the United States. If you were to guess how many of the, our states would you say you've hunted in?
I don't know. I think almost all the Western states, whether guiding or hunting myself or some form of something. I think I've held tags in pretty much all the states out West, but, the guiding season does, it's funny because I actually still guide. And it's something that I do love to do. And that does it's like, okay, well that season, you know, prevents you from going other places. I guide in Montana during the fall, from like September through November. And so like any hunts outside of that September through November season are either like weekend hunts around there or whatever. So that does slow down the hunting other places outside, like in certain seasons. But for the most part, like my personal hunts, I try to do in that August, find a little bit of time in September. And then there's like a week in October. But I've hunted a lot of the Western states. Now outside of the Western states, there's like a couple places I've hunted, like Oklahoma or Texas or whatever. But most of the like US hunting that I do is Western big game based.
So it's funny, you know, you talk about you're still out there guiding. And I think it's kind of funny because I've talked with a lot of awesome people on this podcast. And I think there's this perception of, for lack of a better term, and you may cringe when I say this, but I think you would be considered a somewhat of a celebrity hunter. Like people know you, you have a lot of media out there. And I think there's a concept of like, okay, well, you know, that's all you do. You know, all you do is you go out and hunt and you don't do anything else. And that's like your whole livelihood. And that is making these awesome films and TV shows and podcasts. But you do other things. You go out and guide and you make a living that way. And it's just an interesting thing, I think, where people's mindsets are when they watch you on a TV show or listen to you on a podcast. They're like, oh, this guy, that's all he does is go out and hunt. And that's his entire living for the year.
Yeah. I think too, like part of it for me, like I really, I love the aspect of guiding because it's like, it really is kind of like, I think one of the highest forms of just like knowing what you're doing. To be able to take somebody that might not know what they're doing and make them successful in a situation that might be hard to be successful in and regularly, like it can be very difficult. And so I think that like, it's a way that always tests my skills. And you know, it's like, I mean, I built, it was like, I worked really hard to get my own outfitting license. Like I worked through college and like built a name and reputation for being a good guide. And then when I think I was 22 years old when I bought, like started my own business and had to like buy out another outfitter. And, you know, I used the money that I'd saved up over the 5 years of like working or whatever to like help start that business. And it was like, man, my blood, sweat and tears went into it. You know, I built like a pretty sweet lodge cabin, like that we built ourselves. And so it was like, you know, a lot of my life went into getting to that point. And I don't think is something that I'd really ever give up. Also, I think it just like, you know, it gives me, I feel like I get a little bit of street cred while I still guide, you know, I feel like the day that I give that up, I'm like soft. I'm like, you know, it's like just kind of, it's a mental thing for me too, where it's like, yeah, I could probably go do other stuff, but, something that I love to do. Now I talk about it, but also, you know, people are always like, oh, he's a guide, I want to go hunt with him. I'm not like, we don't have like it's just me and like a couple other guys. I have other guides that work for me, but it's a pretty small operation. Like we, you know, like we have repeat clients that have hunted with me. Some of these guys have hunted with me for 11, 12 years, like before I was doing any of this media stuff or anything like that. Like, you know, so it's actually kind of almost impossible to get a spot on our Montana hunts. But yeah, I always try to throw that out there, because otherwise I get a lot of like messages and stuff, and I'm like, and I can't answer them all because it's just me. It's not like I have a bunch of people sitting there answering all the emails and doing all the other stuff. So yeah, I always have to put that caveat out there that, yeah, I do guide, but the odds of me guiding you are very, very small, only because there's a limited amount of spots, and those limited amount of spots are normally already full. So.
Well, and I think some people probably also are reaching out like with this, I don't know, this kind of expectation I can imagine, where it's going to be a TV show if they go, like it'll be just like a TV show if they go out with you, and it's going to be like you and them on top of the mountain, and like it's going to be this, I don't know, very dramatic sort of a thing, and there's going to be cameras or something. Yeah. I don't know, I feel like somewhere the people that are reaching out in the back of their head, they're getting that like glorious grand expectation. And it's like, so probably just going to be like any guided trip,
like any guided trip, but way better.
Yes. Yes. Because, not to say that your outfit is just like any other guided outfit, but yeah. So, I did have some people reach out, and, you know, we did just come off this Western Hunting Summit, Mule Deer Summit. And I personally am I've got two big hunts planned this year. I'm going down for Arizona elk. And I also am going to go do some over the counter mule deer. And, muley, I've always been really, really passionate about elk, but mule deer has always had a special place in my heart, 'cause it's the first tag I ever filled. And so I get really, really excited for these over the counter public land hunts. And I've got a few questions, and I did have a few folks reach out with a few of their questions about mule deer. So if maybe we could go through a few of these and see where it ends up taking us. One of the big things I had somebody ask me is, you know, and I know you spend most of your time kind of on the Western states, mountain hunts, but I had somebody reach out, and all the advice they end up getting tends to be on mountain mule deer, like high country mule deer. They were asking, how do you see tips and tactics differ when it comes to mule deer in more like the plains or sandhill locations, or maybe desert locations, versus kind of the cooler alpine locations?
Yeah, I mean, the tactics are actually very, very similar. You know, like it really depends the type of topography that you have. Like, if you don't have a lot of topography where you can glass like from a distance, then your tactics are going to be more like, I would just call it like roving, where you're moving into places that you can like coulee to coulee, canyon to canyon, and glassing and looking for those things that those deer might be like concentrating around at a certain time. So, you know, like also one thing that you kind of have to think about with anything you're hunting is like you need to find the thing that's rare that they need. So if you're out in like the sand hills, well, you know, deer are going to need shade to bed, and there's not a lot of trees and some of that more open plain stuff. So you're going to have to find those spots where they can get shade and bed. And that's really going to limit the amount of plate. Like there's a lot that starts to narrow down the land that those deer are going to be. So, you know, it's like, okay, well, only a certain side of the hill is going to get shade in the middle of the day. Maybe there's some juniper trees or cedars in this certain canyon, you know, they're going to need that shade. Maybe they're just bedding underneath a ledge or something like that. So pinpointing where those shade areas are going to be, and you've got a really hot spot for where they're going to go after they feed and where they're going to bed at. You know, same thing in like desert, you know, if you're in a real desert arid area, maybe it's flat and you can't really glass a lot, tall sage, you might not be able to see a lot of the deer, but you go, well, what's missing? What do they need? Maybe there's not a lot of water there. So you can go find a tank or something that's going to concentrate the deer. And that's really going to just focus your attention on the something that's vital to the deer, but maybe a more rare resource or something that you can easily pinpoint. And that's how you just pinpoint those deer. So the same applies and actually makes it easier. I think it's easier than like hunting some more big mountain stuff where, you know, maybe the entire area has everything that they need. So how do you decipher where they're going to be there is a little bit more difficult than some of these areas where, you know, you've got a lot of feed, but you've got like limited shade. So you can kind of focus in on particular spots. And I think that really helps when I go to areas that are a little bit different.
You know, it's funny you bring that up, because I actually experienced that a lot over this past year, because I always buy that, you know, I mentioned I'm doing it this year. I always buy that over the counter archery tag for Arizona for deer. Cause I'm always putting in for Arizona. I already have the license, might as well buy fairly inexpensive tag. That's great for a long period of time. And so I go down there, and that's kind of where I got my hands-on learning experience for hunting mule deer. You know, I've listened to more podcasts than probably just about anyone. I've watched countless YouTube videos. I'm a researcher, so I've done it, but hands-on experience, it has been down in Arizona. So I learned that kind of technique where it's okay. You, like you said, you got to find what is missing. And so you get in, you find the water, you find the shade, whatever that may be. And you can really pinpoint glassing areas. And then this last year I was in Montana and all of that was hugely abundant. Yeah. And I just felt so overwhelmed. I was like, I don't even know where to start. It's like there's so many places they can be, like, you know, so you pick up, you know, how would those tactics, like now I'm coming at it from the opposite direction. I'm used to being able to like look for those little locations to glass up something. How would those tactics differ then in maybe like a place like Montana or Idaho where, you know, you're looking at a hillside and you're like, okay, well, yeah, there's pretty prolific opportunity for these mule deer here. Do you just grit it out at that point? Like, you know, where do your techniques fall then?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's just more of like, yeah, you got to get boots on the ground and really just start looking for the animals. I mean, I kind of like when I start looking, I look at certain places first, you know, because there's places that you will go that look great. I mean, I can think of like a couple off the top of my head that I'm like, okay, it's this amazing, like big burn, everything animals need, and you'll never see anything there. Maybe occasionally. And it's not that I still don't look all the time just to prove, like, it just looks so good. And yet you never see anything there. And on this one other hillside, you always see deer. So, you know, it's like 99% of the good deer country is going to hold zero deer. It's all just going to be, or I'd say 90%, you know, all the deer, 100% of the deer are living in 10% of the terrain. And maybe there's not a lot of significant difference, but there is something different about it. So what you do is you kind of like figure out, okay, once you start finding deer, where was it, you know, like make mental notes and then find things that are very similar in other places. And that includes like, look at a topo map and like where those deer hang out, what's the topography look like? What direction is that hill facing? Like there's something about it that they like. And maybe it's just for that certain time of year or whatever, but then you go replicate that other places. And I've had a lot of luck doing that, even just using like a topo map. Like maybe I'll be hunting in a spot in Nevada and I like find a bunch of deer in this pocket. I look at the topo map and then I go and find maybe even in a different unit or a different state, I can use that kind of like basic topography to kind of start my search. So I just kind of like have this catalog of like experience and where I'm seeing things and what it looks like, and then find those places, other places. And over time you get really good at doing that. But it's one thing that's like, I can tell you what I look for, but you also kind of have to have that like basis of the way you hunt and how, where you actually find animals, you know, and build your own like out of experience, I would say database on where you're going to start looking. And that might be different than the places that I like to hunt or start to look, but it could still be successful. So that's what I do. And if I go into a new area and I start finding deer, you know, then I start kind of looking at those similar areas. Now, if I like, maybe I'm in an area and I'm in the it's like early season and I'm like down low and I'm seeing 100 deer, but no bucks. Well, I call that a nursery. And it's like, well, maybe there's something about this region that attracts the does. Now I got to go find another area where I start seeing bucks and then kind of separate out those types of areas. But it really just helps you build and focus on where to go, because it can just be this huge swath of land. But the nice thing about that is, you know, maybe in that you find a spot that somebody else isn't going to find. And it's really weird what you might kind of discover doing that. Like a few years back, there's this one place that I was like September, Montana, big mountain, and you go, okay, like look everywhere and there's places I never see deer. And then there's this one canyon where I always see deer in September. And so I just started, you know, like I actually had a hunter with me and I'm like, okay, there's going to be deer in this canyon. And they're like, what? Yeah. And we sit down, look, and there's 20 bucks in there. You're like, okay, that's crazy. But I start watching those bucks and they start like that time of year, they were just like feeding on this elderberry bush. And that really got me thinking like, okay, maybe it's like deer crack and I should go find other, that was the only place on that mountain that had elderberries. Maybe I'll go find another spot that has those this time of year. And sure enough, started picking up bucks in those. It was like a more wet area on a certain hill that had a certain type of thing that I never even knew deer liked. So it's just like something like that can just be a little bit of a edge when you start looking for deer or whatever.
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, to simplify all that, it's, I mean, you have to find deer, you know, you do your best. Once you find deer, you look at that area and, you know, you list out, okay, these are all the different qualities of that area. Then you look for similar stuff. You look for that in a different place. You list out all the qualities of that area and you can kind of start to cross-reference and narrow down what those may be. You know, you got maybe 10 qualities, whether it's vegetation, topo, water, all of these different qualities. And you can start to then narrow those down to the key pieces and really see what the most important portions for those. And like you said, then you can apply that to other hunts, other states, and it gives you a starting point. So you're not just jumping in completely fresh to every hunt.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, as things change, you know, like if you go down to Arizona, what the deer are looking for there are completely different than what the deer are looking for in Northwest Montana. You know, it's like deer in Northwest Montana have plenty of cover. They've got plenty, you know what I mean? They're looking for maybe some more open and maybe some drier stuff. Whereas in Arizona, maybe they're looking for some water and some like succulent good food and whatever. You know, there's just so many different things that they're looking for in different places. But yeah, just filling out that catalog and just understanding, it's just like anything, you know, finding what's rare but valuable to the deer. And that's kind of how you can narrow down your search.
Do you actually keep like a physical notebook of things when you're in the field?
I used to, and it's funny because I was actually just like reading through some of the stuff the other day. And I mean, it's like stuff that I've like trips or days or whatever, like I forgot a lot of stuff, unfortunately, but I don't anymore. I mean, now like I just, it's like I have so much of that data over the years. I mean, you know, I've spent literally thousands of days in the field hunting. I mean, at this point, I've actually spent more days out hunting than not hunting, which is, it was just pretty crazy to think. Like, I've spent the majority of my life now at this point outside chasing animals. And I mean, I'm not saying that's like brag or like whatever, but it just gives you an idea of like, that's how committed I am to this. You know, I mean, I found ways to guide in other countries and and hunt other places kind of year round. And so, you know, like that's given me an edge on just understanding and building up like kind of that database of some of it too. You kind of just like, I mean, as long as you're like actively hunting and thinking about things, you kind of like start to get a feeling of what feels good. And that just kind of comes with experience as well as, you know, maybe you don't even have any experience. Maybe it's just, you know, you've got a good feeling about this canyon. There's probably a reason you do. So I do follow that a lot as well. Like, I just kind of let my instincts guide me in some ways.
Well, so much of what you know, I'm sure it's like back in the day you had to consciously be reminded of it, but now it's so ingrained, and that's why you can trust those like hunches about a canyon or something. You may be almost subconsciously picking something up. You may be looking at it and it may be tripping something that you're not sitting there thinking very super consciously about, but it's tripping some memory or some experience you had prior. And that's what's really keying you in on that spot. And that's something that, yeah, only comes with thousands of days in the field. You know, when you've only been hunting for a couple of years, it's still going to take you a while to develop that.
Yeah, I do. I will say though, like if you're new to hunting, you know, I think one thing that like really, really makes people not as successful is like a constant act of self-guessing. You just have to like, and actually that's one of the reasons I really enjoy hunting alone, is because when you're with other people, you're always like bouncing ideas back and forth and you're actually like thinking slower and like, you know, feeling less like you're just, the act of hunting is more like broken down into an analysis. And I mean, yeah, I'm talking about tactics and the way that analyze things, but also you can like really hinder your success by just overanalyzing things. You just sometimes have to be like, yeah, I feel like there's going to be a big buck in here. And when you feel like there's going to be a big buck in there, then you're looking to prove yourself right, as opposed to, I don't think there's anything in here. And then you're going to kind of like, your mind like has a different set of focus. And I see that happen a lot with people that are new, like they feel like they don't know what they're doing. So they kind of like keep bouncing around. They don't look in as hard as they might here because they think that they should be over there. And it's like this constant like thinking and moving and changing and doing different, which is okay. But, you know, sometimes it's good to just stay focused on something and you end up being successful that way. Like your mind is focused more on the positive portion of what might happen. And then you kind of like make it happen in some instances, I guess.
Well, you know, it's an interesting concept because there's so much truth to like your mind creating your reality to some extent, you know, and there's a lot of people that take that way overboard and, you know, manifesting your own destiny, all this stuff. But there is a huge amount of truth in that, you know, what you think becomes reality to some extent. You do create your own destiny, whatever you want to call that. But yeah, like, yeah, I mean, you gave a great illustration of that where, you know, if you have told yourself and convinced yourself that there's a buck or there's a bull in this canyon, you are going to check every single possible spot that they could be, even a few spots they probably couldn't be logically. You will stay there longer. You will find it. And because of that, you will probably find something in there. Versus again, there may be a spot that has several elk in it, or several deer in it, but you convince yourself that there's nothing in there. You're going to just check the few most obvious spots and probably miss quite a bit. And so I think that's such an important, you know, creating your own hunting reality, if you will,
yeah,
with your thoughts and decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I'm everyone's guilty of it, but I do notice that like over time when I'm like, go to a spot, I'm like, oh, I should go, maybe I should go over to that other side of the mountain. Like that looked good too. Oh, this looks good. I don't see anything. Yeah, probably the other side's where I should have been. And then like, you waste your time, like, not focusing in on where you're at while you're there. And I know that's like, okay, maybe if you just sit down and say, this is where I'm at, I'm going to just like work this until later, and then I can go check that tomorrow, whatever. But right now I'm here, I'm going to hunt this, and, or I'm going to, you know, make this route and do that thing and just stay focused in that. Like, I'm not saying that you get into a spot that has nothing and you just, you beat it to death, because I definitely am the type that moves on a lot. Like, I get somewhere, I sit down, I glass. If I don't see what I'm looking for, I generally go, but I know what I'm looking for, you know? So, I think that's a little bit harder when you start out, but you know, I don't get married to spots like some people do. And not that that's a bad thing. Like, there's a lot of different ways to hunt. I think one thing you got to do is you got to find out how you like to hunt and then like build that skill set, because everybody likes to hunt different ways. Everybody does things a little bit different. And, you know, if you find success a way that you enjoy, then continue to hunt that way. You know, that might not be the same way as someone else. Like, I'm in that way with elk hunting, especially archery elk hunting. Like, I like to call elk. I mean, that's one of the reasons I love guiding elk hunting, is I'd rather almost be the caller than the shooter in most instances. I like that interaction of like tricking elk. So when someone hunts with me, that's the way we hunt. It's like, I'm going to find elk that we can call in. I'm not like spending a lot of time putting elk to bed to stalk them. Like, I just don't even care about those elk. Like, me, and you know, on a lot of hunts for me, like, I mean, I don't even know if I was just like walking into a spot and a big 6-point bull stood up, I probably wouldn't shoot it. I was like, I didn't call that elk in. I don't want to shoot it. Like, that's just not the way. Like, I know that sounds weird, but that's in extreme way of like, there's certain ways that I like to hunt elk during the rut, and I'm going to hunt them that way because it's fun for me. You know, but I have friends that never call. They only stalk because they're successful, and that's the way that they want to hunt them. And that's cool too. Like, you know, everybody's got their own little ways that they want to do it. Not that I don't understand those techniques or haven't used those techniques or whatever, but you know, now I enjoy the calling aspect so much that I choose to hunt that way, especially when I've got someone else with me. I'm like, okay, we're just going to call, and we're going to find bulls that want to call back, and we're going to call a bull in. And if you do that technique, you're going to get one that way. If we would have stalked all week, we would have got one that way too. But you know, you just kind of find what works for you and what you enjoy.
No, I definitely get that. And there's something that's exciting about the calling. And it's just, like you said, it's like it's like that chess game, you're tricking the elk, and there's something cool about that. But I will fully admit, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, I'm still working on that first elk. And so if I was jet boiling my coffee in the morning and an elk just happened to like creep its way out in the forest 60 yards from me and my bow was within reach, I would hammer the hell out of that thing. I'm like,
yeah. I don't care. Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, I'm just on an extreme side. There's ways to, like, some people don't like glassing. Like, if you're bad at glassing and you don't like glassing, develop tactics that you can be successful at without glassing. You know, it's like, there's, you know, hunt areas that you could, because there's guys that are going to be glassing and they're going to be very successful doing it. And that's like, that's how I like to hunt. I like to glass and spot the animal and move in. You know, but there's guys that don't like to do that. So the guys that don't like to do that, you know, focus on putting blinds on water. Like, there's a lot of tactics you can use. And, you know, and like, honestly, play to your strengths in some ways. Like, if there's a certain type of tactic that you like to do, you know, build that skill. I've got friends that, like in New Zealand, that are really good. I would say they're like really good still hunters. And that's something that I've, you know, over the years gotten a lot better at and been very successful with. But there's an art to it. Like, hunting the areas that you can't glass, the areas where you like sneak up on the animal and they're in range, and understanding where you find those animals in a sea of timber. And like, there's some cool, like, it's actually a really cool way to hunt too. Like, there's a lot of different ways you can hunt. And what I think too is just build out all the, like, once you've built out all those tactics, then you're going to be the most successful hunter you can be. You know, when you understand different ambush tactics, like the ability to pick a blind and sit at water and have that patience, and then the ability to go hunt thick timber and the ability to go do a lot of glassing. And then once you've hit that, then you're really going to be successful, because you have every tactic available and you know how to employ them like with precision, and you're really going to be successful in kind of any scenario. And I think that comes with a lot of experience, but it also comes with kind of, you know, trying a lot of different stuff as well.
Well, I mean, I think it just makes you such a more versatile hunter in that, you know, okay, yeah, you may be focusing on this one thing, like with elk, for example. You know, somebody may be out there and they may want to call a bull in and this and that, but elk they're wild animals. They do whatever the hell they want. And they just may not be talking. They may have been talking super early in the season or before the season. They may be making a bunch of noise. You may found this area. You're like, shoot, I'm going to bomb in here. I am going to call and they're going to come tearing in. They're talking, whatever. You may get in there and for some one reason or the other, you may have committed 7-10 miles deep and they may just decide to shut up once you get in there. Being able to change those tactics and do more glassing or whatever that may be, or switch up to some ambush hunting. If it's a hotter area and you know, you can sit water, it's going to make you a lot more successful than if all you can do is sit and call. But you know, it is good to also then focus on what you're good at. And if you are terrible at glassing, maybe start with the calling.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to get at is like, you know, everybody's got a little bit of a different strength and, you know, you can also pick areas based on those kind of strengths is what I was trying to say is like, mm-hmm. you know, you can, if you're, you know, if you really like to sit, but you decide you're going to go hunt an area that has like no possible way to do that, you're probably just going to be sitting in a random spot and waste a lot of time. You know, like, yeah. But like, so you can kind of like play to your strengths, play, and then like, if that's not working, change your tactics. I mean, yeah, I still also like, you know, hunting wallows is a fun way to hunt elk during the archery season. Like, it's cool to watch that wallow behavior. And actually, like, I think that there's a real science to understanding wallows and how elk use them and when they're going to use them and which wallows are going to be active, and like finding those wallows can be a science. And I actually really enjoy explaining that tactic as well. Like, that's something that I enjoy. I'm not real super patient at sitting, but if I'm sitting over a projected elk wallow like that, there's just something more exciting about that to me. So yeah, there's so many just different ways and things that you can do.
Well, and I think there's also something entertaining about an almost 1,000-pound animal with giant antlers rolling around like a small child in a puddle of mud.
Like, yeah, exactly.
We were talking about earlier, just the trusting your hunches and confidence in your areas. That brings up actually one of the other questions that was asked. Somebody asked, generally, like when you're glassing a new area, so, you know, maybe you weren't able to do as much scouting or whatever it was, but you're in a fairly new area. You have a good hunch about it. You know, how do you build that enough of that confidence to really be like, well, do I spend a whole day here, half a day here? Like, you know, I know it's kind of a vague question, but there's only so many places you can be that last 30 to 60 minutes before dark and that last 30 to 60 minutes, you know, kind of around sunrise. How do you decide like, okay, it's time to move on from this area? Like,
I mean, you kind of have to know like a couple of things, whether, you know, like kind of the densities of the area, but you know, I'm like fairly confident in my glassing skills where I sit down and if I look over something in the morning and don't see anything, there's probably not a lot there to see. It also depends on like how much cover there is and how much available open there is. But sometimes I start to think, okay, well, you know, if I'm looking at hillside, 10% of it's open, you know, what are the chances that what I'm looking for is going to come out in that? You kind of have to like make a scientific guess, you know, like when you're counting, like populations for science, and it's like, you take a small area and you tally up the number and then you extrapolate it over a larger area. So you kind of think of that. I kind of have that mentality when I'm looking at like a hillside and I can only see 10% of it. So if I see two deer out in that, okay, well maybe that is equating to more deer in this area. But if I'm not really seeing anything, then I can kind of go, yeah, I mean, this area is not for me. I'll move on. Not that there aren't animals there, but you can maybe go find something easier. And once you start finding animals, then you can start honing in and saying, well, if there's a lot of animals here, there's something that they like. maybe I can find other spots like this. I kind of say that I have, in some ways, like happy feet. Like I like to cruise around. I like to move around a lot. I put in a lot of miles. Not that I don't when I'm glass hard or, you know, whatever, but, I don't burn a lot of time like in an area that doesn't seem very productive either. So I don't know. It's just, that's one thing. Like I know people that'll go into a spot, they'll hunt that the whole season. And that's cool too. Like they're probably really successful doing that. I've got like this don't assume philosophy where I don't assume that there's nothing there and I don't assume that there is anything there. You kind of have to do both at the same time. Sounds weird, but it's like you have to think that there is something there. So when you're looking with the intent that you're going to see something. And you also have to assume that maybe you've looked as good as you can and there isn't anything to see. So move on. And if you do both those things, you'll probably be all right.
be open to both possibilities, but don't fully commit to either one or
fully commit to both possibilities. It's an oxymoron.
There you go. But yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to trusting, you know, developing those glassing skills and trusting them enough to be like, okay, well, I went over this area, going over it six more times. Yeah. Okay. There's a chance something may wander in a few hours and I could, if I continue staring at this spot, but you know, I guess it means having confidence in your skills and making that decision. If I went over an area, I went over it.
And that's the hard part too. Like when you're getting started or even like people that have been doing it a while, but maybe don't have those like, you know, the skills for where they're looking and understanding like what they're looking for and where they're looking. Because like one thing that I do enjoy about the guiding is I get to like hunt with a lot of people and see like how they hunt. And I would say like, you know, when I say guiding, it doesn't mean that like the people I'm taking out have no experience. A lot of them have been hunting their whole life, but you know, it's like elk hunting can be very difficult. If anybody that's tried it, like it can be hard to get good at elk hunting. And we'll sit down on the place that I glass and I, you know, I've hunted a lot or whatever. And I'll be like, how many, you know, over the years, I don't think that rarely anyone will ever spot something before me, unless it's like really close. And, you know, I don't really, you know, it was like glassing somewhere else and didn't see it, but you know, something that just like stands out if it's standing in the middle of the road, I probably won't see it first because I'm looking off in the distance. But, you know, there's a lot of people that I've hunted with or whatever. And like from where I'm glassing, they won't see anything, but I'll end up picking out 300 elk. So it's like, okay, if they were here by themselves, they would think that there is nothing there when in fact there is. I honestly think like if you can find somebody that knows what they're doing and can go with them and just see like that kind of like proof it where you go out with somebody that maybe has more experience. I know that can be difficult sometimes like to find or whatever, but and you're sitting next to someone and they're spotting a lot of animals and you aren't spotting a lot, then that kind of gives you a better gauge of how much time you should spend and whether there's animals when you're off on your own. You know, it's like a good barometer of, okay, last time I was here or last time I was glassing, you know, this person was spotting stuff. So that kind of is like a self-check of like, yes, I'm seeing everything or no, I'm not. Or those times where you're glassing a hillside and you go, oh, there's nothing here. And then 10 seconds later, you look up and there's 20 cows, like giant cows, like cattle that you didn't see before. It's like self-check. You didn't see everything, dude. Like those are just good ways to gauge on like how observant you are. And if you're like actually seeing what might be there.
And that was a harsh realization for me. Cause I'd been hunting for a little under a year at that point. And I went out on my first hunt with some other guys and I learned more about glassing my first day sitting with those guys, like looking for pronghorn than I did the entire prior year of watching videos and reading and just doing it on my own. You read all these articles and watch videos and listen to podcasts and whatever. And it's all great content. You know, it's better than starting from zero. But the second you get out there, you know, you think you're doing it right, but you don't know for sure until you sit down with someone else that's that's been doing it for years, knows exactly what they're looking for and can point things out to you. And it's a humbling realization very quickly. You're like, and then all of a sudden you start thinking back on all those hunts you've been on where you didn't see a blessed thing. And you're like, yeah, no, there's probably a lot of bushes that held a lot of animals that I completely miss.
Yeah, exactly. But that's all part of it. You just got to get out there, get some experience. And once you start finding things, you know, you're doing something right, you know, and then just keep trying to replicate that. And it takes time. Like, I think that's one thing that people have a misconception of is, you know, you can read a lot, you can do these things. And they absolutely help. Like, for me, you know, like there's a lot of things that I had no clue about, like duck hunting. And I got myself into duck hunting when I was a kid, like by reading and understanding and then going out and then you use that as a foundation and a basis to build more skill. But, it really doesn't come into like fruition until you like put it to use out in the field. And that's where you kind of gain the skill. You know, you can gain the knowledge, but then you gain the skill out in the field. And that's key.
Well, and it's, you learn so much from making mistakes. I feel like more than anything else, I think it's when you make a mistake that you know for a fact is a mistake. I think that's when you learn the best lessons, more so than anything you can learn from reading or being successful. And again, the only way you can make those mistakes is by being in the field.
Exactly.
You can't make a mistake watching a YouTube video. I mean, I'm sure there's some people out there that could probably make a mistake watching a YouTube video, but generally you cannot make an educational mistake, reading a book, listening to a podcast.
Oh, trust me. I've encountered lots of people that have made mistakes watching YouTube videos. I had one, like just the stuff people think they know is absolutely ridiculous. I had one guy like sending me a message that I absolutely didn't know how to hunt because I was carrying a backpack around that had all my scent in it. And I'm like, I was like, dude, you've never hunted the backcountry. I guarantee it. Cause you got to carry a backpack. Like you don't go 20 miles from your truck without a backpack, pal. Like, I'm sorry. Like, that's just not how this game works. Like, good luck. Hope you don't die. Sweet. You know, it's just, there's like stuff that people just do not know. And they are so excited to tell you what they don't know.
I mean, I've had maybe one or two people that have come on the podcast that I would look at them. I'd be like, okay, you could go 20 miles deep without a backpack and be just fine for a few days. But yeah, I'm really curious how he thinks that's going to work. Going into the backcountry without any gear whatsoever.
Yeah. Or like the, I don't know. Like, yeah, you didn't even put on any scent lock stuff. There's no wonder you didn't get that buck. It's just like, yeah, dude, I just hiked 9 miles into this spot. Like, I've been out here for 4 days. That's not going to help. Like, I'm going to have to. It's a different game, you know, but I think it's funny how people are so willing to tell you like how to do something when they don't have experience doing it. That's the mistake people make on YouTube.
Scent control is only going to do so much when you've been wearing the same two or three pairs of socks for 7 days.
Like, exactly. Yeah. Not that it doesn't work in whatever, but you know, I think that kind of stuff's funny. It's like, yeah, I mean, and yeah, I'm always open to suggestions for better ways to do things, but there's certain things that, you know, you kind of have to do. Like,
spraying on scent control when you're at the truck is only going to do so much 6-7 days later. And it's, you know, it's funny. And I get a lot of guys, you know, we laugh about this, but I do get a lot of guys that listen to the podcast who, I didn't really expect this when I started, but they are guys who may be back east and have only hunted whitetail, and they'll be listening and they get inspired to come on their first elk hunt. And, you know, you start with what you know, and, you know, they're definitely, you know, further along, say, than I was when I started hunting and had never even sat in a tree stand before. But there's still a lot of gaps in their knowledge, and they may come out not realizing stuff like that. They, who knows, they may come out in a big pair of insulated rubber boots because they don't want to leave their scent. That's not going to be good. That's really going to suck after the first 2-3 miles walking into the backcountry. And so I think those conversations are very important to have, even though oftentimes they do seem silly. And I think on their end, it is also very important, though, to understand where your gaps in the knowledge lie. And because I can imagine, I can only imagine the comments and messages that you get sent your way. Like, it's just, it's gotta be pretty incredible what gets sent over.
Yeah. I mean, so, yeah. It, like, I actually just don't, I haven't read a YouTube comment in probably 10 years. So those are all like old ones, you know, but, I just thought that it was funny. You can't do anything wrong on YouTube. Yeah. Well, no, just kidding. For the most part, I think now people are starting to understand that there are differences. And like, I understand those differences too. When I go to sit and do like a whitetail hunt in Oklahoma, like, I understand that I'm going to have some form of scent control. Like, I'm going to have to do things different. You know, there's different ways to do things. And not that like, yeah, I mean, that would work if you're going into a wallow and sitting and whatever, like, yeah, that's a great tactic to use and have and whatever. There's a place for certain things, but then it's like, you know, if I'm doing a backcountry hunt where I'm living out of my backpack and you're ridiculing a guy for wearing a backpack, that's why he's having trouble killing now. You don't understand what's going on, you know? Like, there's just fundamentals. Like, it's a fundamental difference. But I think, you just have to understand that there's different ways of doing different things in different places.
Man. It makes you wonder. It's like, did you just maybe like, did you actually watch the video, or did you just see the cover, see me with a backpack and ask the question? But
yeah, that's it.
Oh, man. So I do want to throw a couple more of these questions at you really quick. So jumping around very spastically here. One of the questions that I got in was, what changes do you see in a deer's behavior before and after they shed their velvet? And I'm sure a lot of that is kind of probably tied to the rut some as well. But, you know, most places, I feel like that's what probably kind of the summer moving into fall time period, other places a little bit later. But do you see differences in their feeding, their bedding, their overall routine from the time they shed their velvet to the time kind of they're in that hard horns?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, like a lot, you hear a lot, like, you know, like their antlers are sensitive while growing. And I think that there is some truth to that. You know, they tend to spend more time out in the open, before they shed their velvet. They're going to be like up in those more open areas. Now, if it's a thicker area and there's only open, like above timberline, that's actually where they're going to be. Like, it's pretty easy to kind of pinpoint where a lot of them will be. Or they'll be out feeding in the open more often. As soon as they shed that velvet, a couple of things happen. Like, they kind of recluse back into thicker cover, at least mule deer. Even like whitetails as well will do this. They kind of recluse back into thicker cover. And, I mean, it could be a combination of things. One could be not wanting to run their antlers through all this thick stuff, which does make sense. But also, like, there's changes in the type of food sources that they need at that point. You know, the grasses start to die earlier and things start to change around that time too. So, but I noticed that they probably drop about 1,000 feet in elevation for the most part, like depending on where they're at. It seems to be like a pretty consistent thing, unless they're like a very, unless they still have everything they need right there, but they generally like retreat to more thicker cover. And that's why, like, even, and then that kind of like progresses even more into that beginning of October. I think the hardest time to hunt mule deer is probably like the first part of October, because before the rut and after, they're kind of out in those bachelor groups. They kind of, at that point, then they kind of like separate out. In September, they'll stay through, they'll shed their velvet, but they'll keep that bachelor mentality. So it's a little bit easier. And then before the rut, then they split off and then they're like solo. in the more thick cover, and that's actually the hardest time to find them. But, you know, you can still find deer after they shed in their summer patterns, but at some point they're going to start to retreat because they're kind of making this transition from that summer pattern into like this solitary pattern into like fight mode for the rut. So you kind of have to like analyze where they're going to be in those different times. And it's generally like a little bit lower elevation, maybe if they were in the alpine, and like a little bit different type of terrain or cover.
So say somebody is, you know, fairly new to hunting. They're trying to figure out what seasons they want to put in for, you know, maybe they're not so much concerned about their tag draw success. Say, you know, they're resident, they've got a good chance at success. What time would generally be best for them to apply to have the highest chance of success for hunting mule deer? Like, would it be when they're in those kind of bachelor herds? Would it be early season when they're still in velvet? Clearly not October, as you mentioned. Would it be the rut? Like, what would you recommend to someone that wants to kind of get their start into hunting mule deer?
Yeah, I mean, well, if you can hunt the rut, that's the best. I mean, deer are dumb. They're just like, big deer make big mistakes. Then, like, they're out most of the day. Like, it's, yeah, that's a great time to hunt. I'd say outside of the rut, though, I think the best time is when they're in velvet. But, you know, there's obviously, like, easy to get tags. Generally, like, general tags or whatever are based around seasons that it's the hardest to hunt the deer, or like where success is going to be the lowest. Most like general tags happen in that like October season. Easy to get tags are generally that October season. Montana has like a general season through the rut, but you know, like early season is definitely really good. I think that that's probably the best time for like seeing a lot of deer is like August time frame. Not everywhere has seasons then. And then outside of August, I would say the next best time would be November. And then outside of those two times, I would say like probably during late season in December, like a migration type area, or then like September season where they're kind of still bachelored up but not solitary. And then, but you know, you can still have really good hunting in October. When it's difficult, because those big bucks might be by themselves, like they're going to hold a tighter pattern once you find them. Like once you find a buck in that like October season, you probably are going to be able to get on them again, which I think is like a huge advantage. So there's a lot of ways that you can exploit that like weakness that they make. Then they're by themselves, they make a lot more mistakes, and they're holding like a tighter area. So there's good parts to every season, really.
And so this question I have a feeling is going to be kind of super dependent on the area, but you know, I'll kind of let you maybe give your answer. What should maybe a new hunter, someone that's getting their start in bow hunting mule deer, what should they expect kind of their effective yardage to be like? You know, obviously you want to get in as close on the deer as possible, and you want to be as effective out to as far as possible, but maybe a new hunter, how far out should they really feel confident realistically before they're, you know, ready to go out hunting a mule deer?
Yeah. I mean, that is super dependent, but I would say like, if you practice a lot and you're a really good shot, like 50 yards, probably. It's kind of like that cap. But I would always say, like, I think people get this weird thought in their head that, like, you know, like, oh, I could shoot 50 yards, you know, I could kill a mule deer 50 yards. Yeah. But then they stalk in, they get to 50 yards, and that's where they choose to shoot from. I think it's like, okay, if you can shoot 50 yards, make sure you get to 30, you know, because it's like, get to 25. Because if you're already at 50, you're probably going to be able to go 10 yards further, go to 40, go to like, and once you get to 40, maybe go another 5 yards. You know, it's like, just do that, because I think the mistake most people make now, like most guys that do it a lot, like even guys that are really good hunt a lot or been doing it their whole life, because now it's like you can go shoot your range at 80, 90 yards and make a good group and all this stuff. And then guys like creep into 70 yards and they're like, they get afraid to sneak further. And they're like, I'll take a shot from here. And then they muff it. They would like, things happen at that range. when you get into 20 yards, a lot less goes wrong. And I like, that's actually, I mean, I kind of fell into that really early before, like, you know, I've been shooting bows, archery hunting for a very long time. But I noticed, like, I would get into like 60 yards, 50 yards and be like, okay, I'll wait here. And it's like, I stopped doing that. I just said, I'm going to get as close as possible. And man, a fewer things went wrong. And there are those occasional times where, yeah, you blow it getting closer. But in the long run, I mean, honestly, like in the long run, my success is increased by just getting as close as possible. And I encourage everybody to do that, not just because it's like more ethical or whatever. It's more successful. And yeah, you're going to blow a few, but not as many as you're going to mess up at that further range. So that's the way I see it.
So you'd say percentage wise, you're going to blow a lot higher percentages of far shots than you're going to blow stocks, like getting in closer on stocks necessarily is what you'd say.
Yeah, for sure. Because I mean, there's still things that you're still within like that red zone of things going wrong at 50 yards or whatever. Like the wind could shift. And when you're closer in, you're going to have a lot more opportunity to capitalize. It's like, you know, if all of a sudden the wind swirls and the buck stands up and is looking alert and you're like 50 yards, you're like, okay, dude, I can shoot a dime at 50 yards. This thing's gone. And you draw back and shoot, that deer's just going to duck that arrow and be gone. Now, you might fully miss him or you might hit him in the back, and neither of those are good, like, good outcomes. Whereas if you're at 30 yards, you know, you might have an actual chance of killing that deer. So there's just like, you know, it's like that gap makes a big difference as far as things happening. Or, you know, also, like, there's just less margin of error. There's a lot less things that can go wrong at those closer distances. You're just a lot more successful at sealing the deal the closer you get, especially when it comes to the shot. Not that you aren't a good shot, not that you can't make further shots, but just the way the animal reacts, the way that everything, you know, at 20 yards, if a deer jumps the string, you've probably already killed it by the time it finishes jumping the string. At 40 yards, you know, as every 10 yards, that chance goes down and down and down, you know, until you get far enough out that it jumps the string, comes back up in your arrow.
Oh man. So one thing I always kind of like to wind down with is, you know, say you're just out one day, somebody knows your guide, knows your hunter, whatever that is. And they come to you and they're like, hey man, you know, I know you're into all this hunting stuff and it's really cool. I've always wanted to try it. He's like, but I don't know, man. Like, I don't have any friends that do it. I grew up in the city. There's a lot to learn and all this stuff's like just way too intimidating for me. I don't know if I can do this. What encouragement or kind of words of wisdom would you give someone kind of in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally what I, you know, like I encourage them to definitely give it a try. There are things that are difficult about it, but it's not impossible, you know. I mean, really, like, I mean, I even just had somebody ask me the other day, and it's like, I was thinking about hunting, like, what do I do? You know, get your hunter safety, take those steps to where you can actually get a license, and then just kind of like, it's just like anything, you know, get some advice, whether it's from someone you end up finding, podcasts, whatever, go out and give it a try. I mean, I honestly think like the best way to start is a small game, because you can like be successful. You can learn a lot of things. You can do a lot of things, and it's not as like, intimidating to start out. And I think that's like a great way to start out. You know, I think like, it's just like anything, you know, you can start small and grow big, because you're going to gain skills doing that. You can do that. Like, it's a longer season. There's more opportunity, more places to go. It's easier. Like, people are more willing to share those kind of spots than they are maybe big game spots, because there's a lot more time investment in other things. And it's a great way to get out. And while you're out there thinking about other things you might be able to do, because while you're hunting, you know, there's so many times where I've been hunting chukar and found or quail and like, oh, this is a cool deer spot. Maybe I'd come back here. You know, like thinking about the way that I started hunting small game first. So I think that's like a great avenue to get into it. And then I also like encourage people to kind of maybe do, like, if it's something they want to do, you know, maybe try to find some kind of mentor. And the best way to do that's through like conservation organizations. You know, it's like, go, like in Nevada, we've got like a bighorn, like Nevada Bighorns Unlimited, where they do guzzler builds all the time. Go get on one of those, like get your hands dirty with some people that hunt, and they'll be like, oh, you know, what tags you put in for it? And you'll be like, I've never hunted. And I'd say at some point, someone's going to be like, oh really? But you're out here helping. Yeah. I really, it's something I want to, I'm in, trying to get into, like, go to those events and start meeting people that are in that space. You know, it's not, I mean, it's hard to meet new people, but when you kind of get your hands dirty with them and go through those experiences of like helping out, like it's a lot easier to build relationships with people that are willing to help you that way, I think.
No, I think that's super critical. People get really excited when somebody comes in, just does not have any background in all of that, but they're willing to throw down with everyone else. Like, I've seen that time and time again, you know, when I first started, you know, I'd sign up to go on a hike with a group of hunters, even though I'd never been out. Like, shoot, I flew out of, you know, I found some cheap Spirit Airlines tickets and I flew out of state tons of times to just go to events and conservation events and different things, and, you know, find your local ones and find ones that you can just make your way to. And it's people love, I mean, I don't know a single hunter that doesn't want to sit and tell hunting stories and talk to someone, you know, help teach someone that knows less than them. I mean, it's a nice ego boost for them sometimes, you know, feeling like they get to share their wealth of knowledge. And, you know, I know very few hunters that don't want to grow the hunting community. So it's a fantastic opportunity to get out and meet people.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, man, thank you so much for taking the time. If folks wanted to follow along with everything online, where can they find you?
Yeah, I do mostly everything on Instagram. You can find me at Remy Warren. You can also check out my podcast, where I give a bunch of cool tips, called Cutting the Distance Podcast. Pretty much anywhere podcasts are found. And yeah, I mean, those, and then, you know, some YouTube stuff, Solo Hunter on YouTube, or Remy Warren at YouTube. I'm going to start doing more how-to tips and tactics. That's pretty much everywhere.
Awesome, man. Well, again, I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, y'all. That'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. That'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, and head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.